and welcome to another episode of Fool's Daily, episode 4 of Guild Ball Week, and we're actually going to find out how you play Guild Ball today.
Finally.
Yeah, I'm joined again by Matt and Loxham, and they are going to tell us about how we play Guild Ball. So, we know it's six figures.
Six figures, yes.
How big a board?
3x3 is the recommended size. That's the size that we've found to be the optimal play experience for the speed which you can move the models about and the ball travels.
Okay. Terrain?
Yeah, so standard 28-30mm fantasy scenery. The Empire Free Cities stretches a huge continent, so you can play on the icy fjords of the north or the baking deserts of the south or the lush jungles of the east. You know, you name it, you can play Guild Ball in that particular terrain, and there'll be full rules for all different types of terrain and how it affects the play.
Cool, and is it a heavy terrain game, or is it a, you know, six or seven pieces type thing?
It's lighter than Malifaux by a long way, yeah.
It's not infinite or Malifaux levels, it's kind of, it's on your lighter side, more akin to more the Privateer Press approach.
Yeah, War Machine kind of style, yeah.
Okay, cool. So, how do I play it?
It's actually deceptively easy to play. What we've done is spent a... I'm going to talk about this bit, and then Rich can kind of step in and talk about the characters. But this is my absolute favourite part by a long way. This is the elegance of...
The dice system.
Yeah, it's the dice system, right? I have spent a lot of time dribbling in Loxham's ear about how important it is to get computations down to a minimal number, transactions between players down to a minimal number in order to speed up the game flow. And what I mean by that is how many times you need to ask your opponent for a stat and how many times you need to make a simple addition or subtraction to the dice that you actually roll. So take War Machine, for example. You need to find out what their def is. You roll two dice. You add the two dice together. You add that to your stat. You compare it to their defense. Take it away. If you have it, end up with a positive number, then you've scored a hit. Then you ask them what their armor is. You roll two dice. You add your power and strength to your two dice. You add your two dice together with the power and strength. Compare it to their armor. Take it away. And that's the net amount of damage that you've done to them. It's a very, very long-winded way of saying that there's an awful lot of interactions. What we've done is simplify it. Essentially, you have a tactical ability that you use when you're attacking someone. That generates a dice pool. So let's say it's six. Okay, so you drag six dice together. You add whatever bonuses you might get. So charge and you get plus two dice to your dice pool. If you've got someone ganging up on your victim, that's another dice. So you end up with nine dice in your dice pool. You say to your opponent, what's your defense and armor? Defense is a number, a bit like an armor save in 40k, but in reverse. The higher the number, the better. And that's your target number for your dice pool. So let's say you're looking at 3+. Okay, so you roll your nine dice. Every dice that's a three or more is a hit. The armor deducts straight from the number of net hits you have. Okay, so if the armor's one, you take one dice away from your four hits that you generated, gives you a net result of three hits. And it literally takes seconds to do. And there's no hard maths, there's no simple maths, there's no maths at all. You are literally just rolling dice and comparing against the target number.
Okay. You did say that very fast.
I know, I absolutely love it. So the other thing, so once you've generated your hits, so the next step is you're able to translate those hits, not just into pure, into raw damage or like an awful lot of games, it is just purely about dealing damage. And therefore it almost, if you summed it all the way down to its core components, it's essentially a dice rolling competition. What this game does is enables you to spend your hits to generate in-game effects. So that you choose tactically, do you want to push the guy back? Do you want to tackle him? Do you want to move your model in a certain direction? Do you want to knock your enemy down? Or do you just want to deal damage? Or do you want to generate a momentum point?
Okay, what's a momentum point?
I'm glad you asked that. So,
I'm an easy host. Me softballs. And...
That's brilliant. So the momentum system. So this is something that we come up with to try and, one, enable players to snowball, but two, to enable your opponent to counter the snowball. And by snowball, I mean actually generate an advantageous position and take advantage of it. But there's a cost to it. So momentum is essentially created or gained throughout a turn. Every time you do a certain action, like kick the ball successfully or you hit someone with enough force, you generate a momentum point. So a bit like in football, when you tap the ball about tip, tap, tip, tap, tip, tap, you build it up like Barcelona, and then suddenly you strike when you've got, you know, everyone in the right position and your enemy's in disarray, you actually strike and you get a shot on goal. And we have the same mechanism. But you can also use a momentum to interrupt your opponent. So if you've got a bit of momentum and someone tries to tackle you, you can step away from them by spending a momentum point to kind of, you know, counteract them. So there's the to and a fro exchange. It's a real currency.
It's a flexible resource that happens throughout a turn, basically, and keeps going up and down. And, you know, you have to be careful on judging how much momentum you've got and what you can do with that. And it adds to the strategy levels of how your turn is going to play out.
Because the thing with the strategy is the momentum you have left over at the end of the game adds to your initiative role. And what I should have said at the beginning is it's an asynchronous single model activation game. So you basically, a bit like Malifaux, you flip for initiative. So in our game, you dice for initiative. And then whoever has the highest result gets to choose whether to activate a model first or second. And then you alternate turns until all models have been activated. And then you go, then you flip, then you roll for initiative again. So you could build up a huge amount of momentum and just basically keep that control of the game by consistently winning the initiative role and enabling you to have that choice. It's a very powerful choice, but it's at the expense of perhaps not doing as much actually with that momentum in game. So there's a constant dilemma to the, you know, it's an agony of choice with the momentum. Do I spend it? Do I keep it? Do I hoard it? Do I need to use it to react to my opponent? It's a lovely mechanic.
Yeah, it depends what you value in the turn, and it, you know, it does refresh on a whole turn basis, so you can't just continually stack it up and then, you know, use this amazing last turn of the game. But yeah, you know, it is a flexible one, so it also means that if you are kind of in a losing position, it doesn't mean that you're always going to continually get destroyed.
Yeah, but as you say, yeah, the reset at the end of each turn prevents the snowball carrying on for the entire game. You know, it gives you a chance to get, you know, to reset the clock, get back into it. Bit like real football.
And do the factions that you choose have effects on momentum and the ability, what you can do with it?
Yes.
Yes. I mean, the best example is the Morticians, for instance, because they have kind of a kind of, not negative, but the manipulation of momentum. And a lot of their actions, when they kind of generate, it can actually take off the opponent's momentum, etc. So they're quite an interesting faction for playing with this mechanic, and we've made quite a bit of effort to make sure that they showcase some skills that the other three factions don't tend to have. They're usually about just generating it themselves.
And the fishermen, because they're all about movement and agility, they generate quite a bit of momentum throughout, you know, their turn. The butchers generate momentum through kind of just hurting people, and they can use that momentum to hurt people more. So, you know, every faction has each character within the faction has his own kind of, at the moment, unique skills and abilities. I'm sure at some point they'll become a common pool, but you can spend momentum to trigger these in-game effects as well. So a little bit like spellcasting in a way.
Mm. Okay. You've mentioned dice a few times. Are we talking D6s or are we talking D10s? Or
no, D6s. I mean, because you're looking at a target number, it's actually mathematically academic whether you use a D20 or a D6. But a D6 is ingrained in us as from birth, or from a very young age playing Ludo or, you know, Snakes and Ladders. We instinctively know how to read a D6 the fastest, and because we wanted a fast game, we went with D6s. And everyone's got a bucket of D6s, right?
Yeah, but are we going to be able to get faction ones?
Does a Pope wear a funny hat?
Because you know that gamers are going to go, oh, I need faction dice.
There's absolutely going to be faction dice. It's one of my, it's on my to-do list for this week, actually, is to start sourcing some, I'm thinking like some marble, but with traces of red for the butchers, like a, you know, like a butcher's block kind of feel. Morticians can be sort of like granite-y kind of cold cemetery sort of colours. Yeah, I'm kind of checking out all the different dice manufacturers, trying to find the coolest dice I can.
Nice.
Mm.
So, how do you win?
So, the objective of the game is to score 3 goals. So, a goal is essentially a 50 mil base objective that's placed in your... 6 inches from your touchline, and your opponent is opposite, central to the board. So it's 18 inches in from the side. And it, basically, you need to get the ball to connect with your, you know, your opponent's goal, and you score a point. It's a perpetual motion game. So once you score a goal, a bit like Dreadball, actually, the ball is fired out from the goal back into the field of play. So there's no reset like in Blood Bowl. So if you overcommit to scoring a goal, your opponent can quickly counter and score a goal back if they keep a player further up the field. So there's a lot of sort of positional balancing that needs to happen. And in a way, it's a very nice balancing mechanic, because sometimes, however hard you try, your opponent gets away from you, and you actually cannot prevent him from scoring a goal. What you can do is say, well, I know the ball's going to get fired out. I'm going to move my guys into position and try and counter-attack you as quick as I can.
Okay.
I'm going to dive in with some other stuff then. So
yeah, go, feel free while I just flail.
Mention the influence system, Mark, because that's quite a big one.
Yeah, so the influence system was inspired very much by the risk management mechanic that you see in games such as like War Machine and Hordes and things like that. And essentially, your characters, each of the models generates an amount of influence that they can have on the team through one particular turn. Now, that creates a pool at the beginning of the turn, and you allocate that influence out to the various models. Now, for each influence, you can perform an action. Each character has a varying amount of maximum influence you can put on them. So it becomes a game of misdirection and bluff and counterplay at the actual deployment of the influence. So let's say I win initiative and I load a whole bunch up on my right-hand side. And I stick one or two over on my left-hand side. I'm actually setting myself up to draw you into the right-hand side, to whiz the ball over to the left and use that the 2 points over on the left to kind of power up the field and have a shot on goal. So you're actually looking at what your opponent's doing, trying to second-guess why they're allocating the influence where they are, and then you're going to try and counter them. So that's the advantage of going second. You get to counter. The advantage of going first is you get to establish the bluff. So there's elements of poker in there. It's that kind of, I know, it's a bit like in Malifaux, where you're trying to guess what schemes that your opponent has, and everything like that. So I do like that kind of meta game, feel to it, where you're trying to play your opponent as much as you're trying to play the game.
Okay. Now, I assume that with both of you coming from a big War Machine scene, that you've applied some of the sort of rigidity of rules that game is famous for to your Guild Ball set as well, to make sure that there is no ambiguity of with it, you know, the words within or nearly within and that sort of thing. Do you have a big glossary of defined terms and all that stuff?
Yeah, we have defined terms already that we've kind of established, again, taking from the excellent work Privateer have done on that. I think as well as that, from the start, the game has been developed to be played in tournament style games. So we've been really, really clear to make sure that all rules, you know, are not exploitable, very clear and apt to be played. And I think it has realized a rule set that is really clear to play, and that when people pick it up, and that because the mechanics are simple, like Matt was saying before, and because the rules are so clear and there's a lot of clarity in it, the game flows very, very nicely when you actually play it.
We've normalized the rules, and we continue to do so to basically reduce complexity and simplify as best we can. There's an awful lot of examples in any number of games of rules that are put in just to create complexity for no apparent design reason. So we're trying to eradicate them as much as possible, and you end up with a game that's super clean to play and yeah, very unambiguous is what we're aiming for, so we can support the tournament scene.
Okay. So moving from the rules and how into the characters themselves, are the character cards? Does each character have, as well as stats, a set of unique abilities that then interact, etc.?
Absolutely. I spent quite a lot of time doing the teams and the cards and going through with Matt on how they're going to play. Again, coming back to the fact that, for instance, the Butchers are going to be your damage types, but the cards come in two forms. So you have the front of the card, which has your clear stats on it, and it has the playbook, which is what Matt was mentioning before about how the hits are allocated and what abilities that will give you access to. But on the back of the cards, we haven't revealed yet, so another exclusive for you, is more kind of the unique or the individual abilities. If I take the Fisherman, for example, if we look at Kraken, the big guy on the Fisherman team, he has a harpoon, effectively, which can be used to drag opponents, and that is one of his abilities that he can spend influence for to actually use. Some characters as well have kind of dual-purpose abilities that not only can be spent for influence points, say maybe cost one influence point to use that ability, but they could actually activate that ability by making an attack and hitting one of their specials, which could mean they don't spend the influence for it, but actually access it through the hit they've actually done.
Cool. So just on the characters, is it... Well, you're saying that you activate... throughout the turn, is it an AP based system, or how does that work? How do you know how much you can do with a particular character in a turn?
So it depends on how much influence you put on him. So you could put five blobs of influence onto one character, and he can do five things.
There's a little cap on that. To be fair, the influence caps on per character are different. So certain characters maybe only be allocated one influence, where other characters might have, as Matt said, five influence. So okay. It does kind of limit and kind of promote the kind of differences there.
Okay, so in a similar way to Infinity, for example, where you could theoretically spend all your control points on one unit, making that unit do lots of things in your turn, you're using your influence as a resource to determine which players are going to do the work for you that particular turn.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, you could just play it all on your leader Ox or Shark and make him doing a ridiculous kind of turn where he's... you know, doing horrendous damage, jumping around, grabbing the ball and moving up the field, but the rest of your team then will suffer for that, and they're not going to have access to a near amount of flexibility as he's just done. But that might be the right play in that situation. Totally depending.
Yeah, is there a sort of a fatigue system where if you do make one of your players do the bulk of the heavy lifting, does he then go, "Oh, I've done all the work, you go and do it now"?
Oh, we haven't thought about that.
We haven't thought
of
fatigue.
At the moment, no.
The one issue we kind of had with fatigue systems was that it tends to be the one thing that when you're tracking information, you kind of struggle and you forget, is that active, all activated, what's it done? And I think with the influence system, because we're using beads effectively, our tokens to put next to the models, it's pretty clear what can do what. And when they've got no beads left, the effect of the model's been activated and done.
Cool, and you allocate influence at the beginning of the turn, is that?
Yeah, so yep. As Matt said before, you allocate the influence, and again, there's kind of that little bluffing mentality of your opponent, seeing where you're putting the influence, and kind of shows what your intentions are at turn or not, if you're kind of being crafty.
Which is why it's probably wisest to not pile all your influence onto one character, because it's very easy for your opponent to counterplay that then.
I think in the playtest and that, you know, we've tried the mentality of putting it all on one, and you know, at times it's been very beneficial, but we start now, I think we do tend to kind of spread it about and get it a much more open field to keep our plans much more hidden. It's quite powerful.
Yeah, you see that sort of thing in games like Saga, where you're allocating, I mean, effectively a Saga dice is like an influence point from the sounds of it, and you can make the same unit do everything, and then, but the rest of your army is just standing around doing nothing.
Yeah, pretty much. And you can get countered so hard on that.
Yeah, you can. Well, our timer went ages ago.
Oh.
I was really interested in what you guys were saying. So if there was one point that each of you could make about the rules and the characters, what would it be? Loxham, you first.
Clean. Relatively simple to pick up, extremely hard to master, and I've gone for more points here, am I?
We've had three so far.
I think they're the two main ones, and obviously the uniqueness of each race comes through each faction, each guild.
Cool. And Matt?
I think Rich has covered a lot of the big hitters. I think one of the subtle things that I want to talk or just briefly mention is the combo play that's available by hitting a pass, generating momentum points, spending it immediately to then move that player, activating that player on your next activation for them to move again and shoot. You get these wonderful, fluid passing plays that I've never truly experienced in games like Blood Bowl, because it's so risky to throw the ball. It's even risky to pick the ball up in Blood Bowl, whereas in Guild Ball, we wanted the ball to move about a lot more, so we've made it very easy for the ball to ping all over the place, you can create some wonderful passing moves. It's really good fun when it pulls off.
Tomorrow it will be questions from your loving fans.
Ooh.
So until then, I've been Mike.
I've been Matt.
I've been Luxem.
Bye bye. You can contact Fools Daily on Twitter. We're at Fools_Daily. Or via email, foolsdaily@outlook.com.